Hello, and welcome to The Making Of, a Nat Geo podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Wilson-Hunt, and with me today from Nat Geo's incredible four-part docuseries on Disney Plus, Secrets of the Whales, is executive producer, writer, and director, Brian Armstrong, and composer, Raphael Thibault. Welcome, Brian and Raphael. It's so nice to meet both of you. And I have to say, this show, Secrets of the Whales, is absolutely something that has just moved me beyond words, really. And I told Brian Scarry that I cried a number of times. And I was curious if you'd heard that from other people as well. Brian, have you heard that feedback?
Oh, yeah. We felt that ourselves in making it.
Oh, you did. Okay.
It's one of our ambitions, rightly or wrongly, at Red Rock Films. We say you shouldn't just see a film, you should feel it. And we had this little goosebump test when we were creating the films. And did it give you goosebumps? What emotion are you feeling? And then, of course, that's where Raph comes in, because sometimes that's really often driven by music, helping to tell us what the filmmaker wants you to feel.
Oh, that's absolutely so true. And Raphael, have you heard that as well from all your friends? Probably you have a lot of global friends, I imagine, who have consumed the show.
Absolutely.
What have you been hearing from your friends?
Yeah, the same. Actually, everybody was telling me, like a lot of people said they cried, but it was always very specific, you know, like that was this very specific moment, and they were all different. And I was very surprised by that. So yeah, I definitely got that feedback too.
Yeah, depending on if you have children, if you're a kid, if you're a parent, I think it sort of resonates in different ways. Anything to do with moms and babies, I think just sort of gets everybody.
I'll let you in on a secret, Stacey. When we were recording with Sigourney Weaver on episode 4, spoiler alert, but there's a moment when we're not sure if we're going to find a calf again or not that we see at the start of the film. And she's reading the script, but she's seen the pictures. And so she has that image in her head and she starts reading. She says, and there she is. And Sigourney starts to cry
in the
middle of our recordings. I was like, oh my gosh. It was some measure of success or pride, but she was crying happy tears. And then she, you know, we actually kept that little recording. She kind of cleaned herself up, and true pro that she is, she kept going. But that said a lot to me, that if you can actually just, you be reading the words and feel that emotion, then wait till you see the pictures and the music.
That is so true. And she's a tough lady too, so you really destroyed her in that moment.
Oh yeah. She kills aliens for a living, right? So right. She's tough. And they were during her recording, because it was COVID and she's in her closet surrounded by clothing,
you know, my goodness.
Add as a buffer. And she had twice she had to go to the window and tell some construction guys to quieten down. and they didn't mess with her.
That sounds very familiar. I think we've all had to do that at least once or twice in the last year.
Right.
So before we talk more about Secrets of the Whales, I would love to know more about each of your backgrounds, because you come to this work from very different perspectives, from different experiences. And Raphael, you specifically have not had a traditional path to composing. You sort of worked in the business world and then found your true passion a little bit later. But I wanted to first talk about your experience with hearing loss as a child. I was so struck to read about that. Tell me a little bit about what that felt like and how severe it was and how you recovered from that.
So the only thing I really remember about it when I was very little is just like these constant surgeries, you know. I remember those masks, you know, to put me to sleep. And that's all I remember of it. But yeah, I had multiple infections when I was only a baby that led me to I couldn't hear from the left ear.
Oh my goodness.
And so my parents actually made me play the piano for that reason. They had been told that piano is a good instrument for that because it's a soft instrument. And also, there were some studies that would say that it's a good piano to re-educate the earring. And also, it's not an instrument that you have to tune yourself.
Wow, interesting.
So that's the reason why I started music and the piano more specifically. I think I found this passion very, very early on. I was already obsessed with films and music when I was a kid. I remember taking my old recorder in movie theaters, you know, capturing moments and music moments in movies, and then go home and listen to them all over again, you know, on repeat.
Now the FBI would be at your front door if you did that.
I know. I think I knew I was not supposed to do that, right. But I was, I don't know how I went away with murder, because really this recorder was so loud. I don't know.
Well, it was probably pretty big too, I imagine. It wasn't on an iPhone, right?
Big old machine. But I have fond memories about that period. And, you know, for me, film music was almost too much of a dream. Like, I was so obsessed with it that it was not possible for me, you know, for me to do it as a job. So it came really after that. And I was literally kicked out of music school when I was 18, when I told my professors that I didn't want to perform. I didn't want to be a performer, but I didn't know what else to do with music. I just knew that I didn't want to perform. So I ended up in communications and I worked at Google for a few years. I still had my piano with me at all time. I always say that, you know, there was a time where I was in Paris and I didn't have an apartment and I would just, you know, stay at some friend's apartment. I always had at all time my 88 keys piano with me.
Oh, wow.
You know, like just carrying it with my backpack and, you know, it would come with me wherever I would go. And so it never really left me, the music, but I had a life-changing event at Abbey Road Studios in 2015, and it was a Google event actually. And then after 2 weeks after, I quit my job and I went, you know, I was a full-time composer.
I love that. I love when people leave the corporate world in pursuit of their artistic passion. That's a great...
Yeah. So suddenly also, yeah.
It's great.
It's very sudden.
I love that. Hey, sudden sometimes is the best route, right?
Yeah, so sure.
That's great. And Brian, tell me about your background and how you got into filmmaking. And did it always start with nature and animals, or did you segue into this particular strain of filmmaking outside of, maybe did you do scripted first, or how did that work for you?
If you really go back, it started with a passion for the outdoors and adventure and animals. I grew up on a farm in the outback in Australia. I remember, my cousin tells me, at her place, I discovered a bunch of National Geographic magazines, and I, at a very young age, and pointed to it and said, that's what I want to do. And I have no idea, you know, I don't really remember that. I don't know. She had stuck in her mind, and I don't know what that was. I grew up in a very, very small community, so the fact that there was always something out there in a big wide world to explore was really what I think struck me as a child. And I just the thirst to just discover that. When I was about 12, I got given an A-frame tent for my birthday, and myself and a friend made some backpacks out of some Hessian bags and wire and a couple of PVC pipes, and we went trekking through the paddocks. So I think that's where it started. And then I got into journalism pretty early in Australia, and just started doing longer and longer format programming. And I worked for National Geographic for about 10, 11 years, which really helped sort of hone those storytelling skills. And then started Red Rock Films about 10 years ago. And specifically, so I wouldn't go up on the ladder, but so I could keep going in the field and exploring and telling stories of conservation and animals. That's just really my passion.
I love that. And I love the idea of you with your PVC pipe backpack and Raphael with her keyboard. You may have crossed paths at some point, right?
Yeah, you should have traded that in for a harmonica, maybe. That sounds like quite a lift.
That would have been easier. Or even flute or no, any other instrument.
Brian, I'd love to know, you know, when we talk about writing and directing in this format and telling these kind of stories, it means something very different from what we're used to in the sense of scripted films and scripted television. So tell me, in collaborating with Brian Skerry, your colleague and really the originator of this whole incredible series, what does that mean for this series? How do you write and direct whales? It's an interesting idea to think, well, you have no control over your subject. So how does that work?
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, Brian brought this great concept to Geographic, and Geographic came to us because, you know, Red Rocks is really, in the US, we're kind of, you know, the premier kind of wildlife company. And we also have a passion for getting emotion into our stories, as I mentioned earlier. So the idea of whale culture and this new lens through which we could see animals really excited me, because it's a revelation in science. I mean, just 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to say that animals could feel love or, you know, or emotion or grief, that was unheard of. Darwin wrote about it in Origin of Species, you know, over 100 years ago.
That was a while ago.
It was a while ago, but it also became taboo to talk about animals in that way. And now scientists are catching on.
Was it taboo to talk about it because it would then implicate us in essentially destroying their habitats, because we were just using animals for our own purposes, not really acknowledging, oh, they actually have interior lives and emotions and families and communities. Is that why?
Well, my supposition is that back then we could only deal with one thing at a time. Let's work out this evolution thing first, and then before we go too far down the path. But it's it has connotations for religion, and I think that there's people eat animals, and I think that there are some scary concepts when you look at an animal and say, yeah, that animal's feeling emotion and has a culture.
Certainly. Well, it certainly has driven the animal welfare culture for years and still does. It's a complex issue for sure.
Yeah. So Brian, you know, he's like had these great resources in terms of who he's, you know, worked with and the scientists he knows, and it was great sort of information about where we should go. But then it was basically up to us at Red Rock to make the films. And we invited him to most of our shoots. I think he came along to nearly half of them. But it was also looking at a big slate, you know, 24 different locations, you know, 100 days in the polar regions. And it was a matter of saying, well, what is it that we want to try and capture? Where are we guaranteed, at least as much as you can guarantee anything, to get whales? Because you just show up, like you said, they don't get the script. They don't know when to show up. And neither, for that matter, neither does the weather. You know, is it sunny? Right. Is there wind? Is there waves? Can you go out on a boat? Is the quality of the water clear enough? Is the, if the whales show up, are they going to just like get angry and keep going, or just ignore you and keep going? Or are they going to stay and do something? It's a tricky thing. And the real answer to your question is that we put the best people in the right place at the best time for as long as possible with the best gear, and cross your fingers. And what we got from this series was a gift from the whales again and again and again. Almost everywhere we went, we got this window, this insight. And some of the stuff had been seen before, but suddenly we're looking at it through this new lens and seeing it in a different way, you know, through the lens of culture. So once we got back in the edit suite, then it was like, okay, let's see how this is going to assemble itself. And it, in a lot of ways, it kind of, the structure of these stories wrote themselves. I think we made, you know, one change from our original scripts in terms of the structure of where we're going and what we're telling.
Did you always envision that each episode would center on a different species of whale? Did you know that early on?
Well, when Geographic came to us, they asked us if we could do 5 hours. I think Brian originally pitched one, and it was clearly bigger than that. They asked for five, and we looked into it, and we said, look, narwhal are just too tricky. We can't guarantee enough footage to get an hour out of narwhal alone, but they are really sister species with beluga. They have so much in common. They're the only two whales that can actually turn their necks like we can, and they live in the same region. And we found out about this pod of beluga that had adopted a narwhal, and about this skull in a, sitting in a museum in Scandinavia, which is now just confirmed to be a cross between a narwhal and a beluga. So there's a lot of things going on with these cultures we felt we could explore. So we combined those two into one episode. And then after that, as we wrote up each species, we went back to Geographic and said, here's our four episodes.
Well, I love the way it's organized because it really lets us spend time with each particular group. And they really are so different from each other. And I think that's really, really special.
Yeah, and that's because you don't want to get the same thing four times, right? And that was really interesting to us. And that kind of, a lot of that evolved as we learned more and as we dug more into the material and the new science that's coming out, how different each of these species are. And then within each species, how different each group is in terms of having its own culture. So it was really rich, rich terrain for us to mine.
And Raphael, as a somewhat newly minted composer, how did you get this job? I'm always amazed at how people get jobs. It's really competitive, I imagine. And also, what element of passion did you feel for whales? Were you always a fan? Was this a world that you wanted to explore?
The way it happened for me was that I think it's, you know, the way you get a job, ultimately, I think, is always linked to the fact that you have, whether you have people who believe in you or not. And my agents, who are still my agents today, approached me years ago, very early on in my career as a composer. And I think they've met Brian or some people in Red Rock's team. And I think it was Sophie, to be more exact. And I think that the year after, Red Rock came back to them saying that they would like me to pitch for this show for the whales. And I knew from the beginning, you know, what it was about. And I also knew that it would be executive produced by James Cameron. So, of course, it was still very early on for me in my career. So I was obviously humbled and honored to be even considered for that project. And then it was just such an amazing, empowering experience with Brian and Andy Mitchell. And I felt very free from a creative perspective. I felt like I could come up with creative angles, ideas, and it would always be okay. And of course, as a composer and a French person, it's difficult not to think, you know, of this reference, like The Big Blue, this French movie in the 80s.
Of course.
With this amazing score by Eric Serra, who recreated the whale sounds. And everybody thinks, by the way, that these are true, real whale sounds, but they're not. They're recreated with synthesizers. And it was hard not to be tempted, you know.
We're right, exactly.
Doing the kind of the same process.
How did you avoid that? Did you stay away from synthesizer and focus more on orchestration? How did you pitch yourself as being distinct from that?
I actually use maybe not the exact same process because we're like, it's 30 years after, but
right.
I know that the production and even myself, we were all kind of worried about whale sounds because we didn't want anything to overstep, you know, the existing sound of the nature and of the animals.
Right.
So it was tricky for me. So I really wanted to do something that would, you know, some sort of signature sounds in the score that would evoke the whales, but not imitate them. Like subtle familiar voices, if I may, you know, in tune with the music, like melody lines and, you know, like in another instrument in the score, not an additional character to the show. And that's why you hear sometimes those signature whale sounds that are completely synthetic. And also they usually happen when there's no narration and there's a lot of room for the music. And that's where I allowed myself to do that.
I love the way that you are able to showcase what you've done, but also allow the whales to have their moment. They don't seem to be competing, which I thought was so beautifully done because they are musicians, right? They're making their own music.
That's such a good point.
You have competing scores in a sense, right?
Absolutely. That's such a good point because this is actually exactly how I felt when I watched the first images, the first footage I got. I mean, this show taught me really that music is everywhere, that it's in the nature. And to be honest, I felt at some point that I had to create music to already exist, you know, like the ultimate already existing original music. And we tend to feel that music is man-made, you know, that's something we created, we invented. But the whales are clearly showing us that it's not true. And they use music as, you know, their language. And this really shocked me. And I was so moved by that. And another prime example of that is some people after the fact came to me and said, I love the way you use cymbals or percussions to, you know, illustrate the waves or when, you know, they slap their fins, you know, yes. in the water and stuff like that. And I realized that this was not on purpose. These were all unconscious creative choices that I think I made because we still have this connection and because we all kind of share this soundtrack that's everywhere.
It's almost like you were each a different band and you came together to do a remix in the studio.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. A good analogy. And also, of course, all throughout, I had to be very, very cautious about not overstep the existing sounds of nature. That was tricky. Sometimes it was just about, you know, when the beluga are communicating and when you have these clicking sounds, like just not use any high-pitched instruments, like avoid piano, avoid high-pitched percussions and stuff like that. So it was really constantly a matter of like working out, you know, working around them.
Right.
But still supporting them.
And which instruments did you prioritize if you could choose any that you felt were most important? Or like you said, the ones that you avoided on purpose?
It's a tricky question because the score is hybrid. So it sounds mostly orchestral, but I actually used a lot of electronic, more than we think there is. Just to enrich and it to kind of make up, if I may say, for the fact that there was not going to be any live player at all. So everything has been done on my computer using my piano, tons of orchestral and electronic plugins and my voice. And it was great to be able to play around with electronic sounds along with orchestral arrangements. It gives you a lot of flexibility and freedom. And I think it led us to some sort of versatile hybrid score. I was very happy with the results, despite the fact that we didn't have any live player except me, you know, my piano and my voice.
You're literally a one-woman band, essentially.
Oh, yeah. That was just me and my piano once again, you know, always.
Just like the good old days.
Yeah.
I was in Bristol at Wildscreen, and this agent, and many agents were handing me CDs for a composers. And I was listening as like, no. And I didn't have a project in mind, but I came across Raf's music, and it really, it just had, you could see the even though that track might not be right for what we were doing, it's had the potential for the kind of emotion. And it really is, from a composer and from Raf, a real act of generosity to do a project like this, to not have the music take over, because that is really tempting. And what we're asking the music to do is to be there, to convey emotion, to help things hold up and last. And that is often more subtle. You know, it's in the, if you don't notice the music, it's kind of a good thing for the most part.
For sure.
But we've got one show that opens up with a 24-second shot of a bubble. Right. So just you're on a bubble for 24 seconds. And we did that because we wanted to bring you into the whale world and lull you into that. And you can only do that if you have the right music track. And then of course the narration comes in that this is the breath of a giant, you know, so it's not just any giant, but a sleeping one. And then we're down in there with the sperm whales. But music allows us to gives us that freedom to really set the pace and bring the viewer into this world of the whales. You're kind of sucked in. We even went to the length of when we were getting out of that world. A few times we come up and we see Brian Skerry, for example. It's never until the second act. You're always well and truly in the whales world. And when we do reveal people, it's always from the whales perspective. And it's those little subtle things that really help keep you in that world.
And now that you say that, you're right. We don't meet Brian and we don't see his face until pretty far into the first episode, yes?
All the episodes, there's no people in the first sort of act at all, the first 10, 15 minutes.
Wow, that's very cool. And not to say we don't want to see Brian, but it's nice to feel that, who's a wonderful guy,
as you know. Brian.
We always want to see Brian.
Well, yeah, and Brian himself said, because initially this came to us as a photographer profile. That's how it started off,
right.
A much smaller project. And when we got stuck into it and Brian and I had a conversation about this is really all about the whales, he was the biggest advocate for that. He couldn't agree more. It's got to be about the whales.
Brian, when you're assembling a crew for something like that in a shoot this complicated and potentially dangerous and involved and also just logistically challenging, what is the most important thing that you ask people before they sign on to something like this? Is it about technical skill, but is it also about kind of just toughness? And are they willing to be outside for 12 hours and get soaked and possibly not eat on a regular schedule? You know, what are you most looking for when you're hiring people?
Well, they have to believe in the project. And all of us do. We know our crews, our people, and we're all the same thing. And they know that, you know, I'm out there with them and we're in Antarctica for, you know, 7 weeks doing the Drake Crossing, which is like going through a washing machine for 4 days.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, you do that because you want to capture these images. It's your passion. It's your life. It's not about the money. You do this great job, as best job as you can, because if you're really lucky, they'll ask you to do it again.
That is very true. Right.
And it's a bit addictive. So the people that we know, that Ernie Kovacs and Hayes Baxley, I mean, these are technically proficient, but they're also artists. And it's you need that combination. And that can be hard to find. But you're also then asking them to sometimes work 16-hour days and go to places where the sun doesn't set, you know, literally for months on end. So it's definitely a passion. But for the people that we work with, they would kill for opportunities like this for sure. So we didn't have any problems finding the right people.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it's a long line of people waiting to get these jobs. It's pretty spectacular. And Raphael, I'd love to talk more about your process in terms of how you're working with the footage and how you're composing. So just for my own kind of logistics perspective, are you set up with monitors and you have the footage on one screen and you're composing sort of on another screen? Tell me a little bit about how that works, because I find that process so fascinating.
So it depends what stage I'm on. Usually I make sure I always have my piano again.
Of course, your trusted piano.
When I watch the pictures for the first time. The first time for me is very important. The first time I'm going to actually see the footage, no matter what footage is it, no matter how final the cut is, it's because I like to see how I react to the pictures. I like to see, you know, the same way the audience would in the first place, and how instinctively convey my emotions through my music. So I have my piano and I just, you know, play around with it and see how I react to it and how my music reflects that. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it will end up being the score. It's just that I like the idea of letting the creative juices flow, you know, at the beginning. And once I've done that, I usually get into a more scientific process, you know, and start infusing ideas, analyzing narratives, creating themes and stuff like that. And in that case, yes, it worked exactly this way. And I usually work on a setup of three screens. One screen is for the pictures, another screen is for, you know, my main software window, and the third screen is for any notes that I would have, you know, from production or things to keep in mind, any research I would want to do and stuff like that.
You have all of Brian's criticisms on another screen, right?
Just to make sure.
Yes, for example, right.
There was not much, to be honest. So I think for Secrets of the Whales, actually, the third screen was used for something else because, again, I felt so free that I didn't feel like I had to. And everything was super intuitive. like the animals just inspired me so much that I really didn't need much.
I can't recall having fewer notes, composer notes. There was only one really tricky spot that we had to, it was a quick sort of change of emotions, what was going on in the space of like 15 seconds. And that was the only curly one I think that Raf had to deal with. But it was just coming back as like, done. And we had not worked together before. In fact, we've never met in person. Thank you, COVID.
Oh my goodness.
Never.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it would not be like that in normal times.
No, no.
But we initially said, can we just do the first episode for us, Raf, and we'll see how it goes. And and that was so great that we just said, oh, look, you're going to do all four, okay? Let's just seal this and work it out now.
I'm so glad because I wanted to score for the belugas. I love them so much.
So we talked about Miss Sigourney Weaver earlier, our favorite narrator and the, of course, amazing actor. And she brings such a fluid sort of beauty to this project. And first of all, obviously her relationship with Jim Cameron being likely one of the reasons she signed on, which is a great relationship. What is it about her voice that you feel makes her such a perfect fit for this, Brian?
We've known Sigourney for a long time. We're collaborating on another project together. And so when this came up and it was clear that the stories of these whales are for the most part maternal stories. And my colleague Shannon Malone had worked with Sigourney on Planet Earth many years ago. That was a different kind of read, but that voice sort of stuck with all of us. At the time, I think it still is the highest rated documentary series that's ever aired in the US.
And that's the Attenborough narration, correct?
That's right. Her narration replaced the Attenborough for the US market. You know, we've known Sigourney for a long time. And then when we said it to James Cameron, he's like, of course, this is, I'll give her a call now. This is my perfect. And we were supposed to give six names of suggested narrators to Nat Geo, and we just wrote Sigourney six times. We just had Sigourney. Okay. We didn't even give him another option because she has this connection with the material. And we knew this from the previous stuff we'd been working with her on, is that she just really feels for animals, has this great empathy. And she's a superstar actress for that reason. You know, she just gets herself into the role and has a voice that is a storytelling voice that will lure you in. You know, it's just kind of like, let me come here, let me tell you a story.
It's very true.
And I think that with the maternal quality that we wanted for this series, it just made it, I can't think of anyone else. It was just perfect.
I totally agree. And Raphael, for your perspective, did you feel that you had to sort of compose around the narration? And did you have the narration to work from when you were actually working?
Yeah, I actually, like most of the writing that I did was to a scratch audio that was a male voice. And it's interesting because I started writing just like I got used to it, you know? But then I got to work to Sigourney's voice at some point and it felt so right.
So it changed your perspective of the process?
Yeah, absolutely. And also because, you know, as a new mother myself, I was just writing music to images of those societies where female are so important, like they are leaders. And I remember this specific moment when, you know, this orca, mother orca, carries her dead calf for days, you know, she won't let go. And I had a few months old baby at home at that point, so I could not relate more. And the fact that at the end, when I heard Sigourney's voice, it was like, this just makes so much sense. And I loved the idea and loved her voice. And I think it's just perfect.
Oh, I love that. That is so sweet. And I have to say, you know, we don't see as many women as men in this space composing for nonfiction or scripted. And not to say that a man wouldn't also feel that way about his children, parents or parents. But there is something very special about what you just talked about and that emotion that you brought to the process that makes me want to see way more women in this space. So Brian, do what you can, okay?
Roger that. We'll do.
And then in closing, I just wanted to talk about sort of the lasting impact of this series on you as people and also in your work. What have you learned from the whales specifically that you feel has sort of changed you? Maybe start with Brian.
The thing that really strikes me, there's a scientist who's working now on a project where we will pretty soon, using AI, will be actually able to communicate with whales. And that scares me a little bit. And I know it's not going to be a conversation, but what if they start asking us questions? Because we've got a lot of owning up to do. You know, why are you, some of you, still hunting us? Research.
Why are you polluting our oceans?
Yeah, we're polluting our oceans. Why are they warming up? What is this, all this plastic stuff? Why are we losing 1,000 whales and dolphins a day to entanglements and marine debris? And I think knowing that these are such sentient beings that have their own specific cultures and specific locations like we do, and to know what we're doing to them is really, Secrets of the Whales is a celebration of whales with these undertones of there's some peril going on. And I think we need to pay a lot more attention to what we can do about that. And some of that is what we throw away, it's what we eat, it's who we vote for. There are things we can do. And I think that the big takeaway for me on this is that they're sort of in more trouble than I thought. They are more like us than I thought. And I think we need to move faster to help them out, these cousins of ours.
I totally agree.
Yeah. And I think that the show really nails something that I've never seen before, to be honest. All these gratuitous acts of generosity and love that we see when, you know, Brian Skerry is being fed a fish, you know, or this orca mother. And I think that in a world where we usually think, you know, eat or being eaten, and it's hard to relate to animals, like it's easy to just, you know, take some distance and say, you know, we're not the same, it's not the same. And we have like the proof through that show that it's just not true, and that we're so similar and we're one big family on one rock. And it changed a lot in the way I perceive this from a personal perspective. And I am convinced that it's going to have the same impact on the audience. But I really think it's not something that we see a lot. And I really love that.
I totally agree. And if we didn't know already how closely tied we are, and for better or worse, maybe too close, that's why we have a lot of problems as humans. This makes the world feel bigger and really more connected. At least that's how it felt for me. And as I told Brian Skerry, I want to go see whales now. I just want to see all of them, as many as are available.
Well, it's also, it's just felt like a lot we could learn from how they act with each other. You know, the sperm whales, they've worked out, Shane Garrow, who's the great scientist, who really is the guy who sort of started this whole voyage for all of us, has worked out that sperm whales are making decisions by consensus.
Wow.
So they're swimming along and they're going to start deciding whether should we take a left turn or not. They can take 2 hours to make that decision.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So, do they dispute election results too, or is that just us?
Well, I think they work it out eventually in 2 hours, which is not too bad, really.
We could definitely learn from them on that front. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. This has added such another dimension of just wonder for me, even just understanding how you executed this. And it really is the show I'm telling everyone to watch, because it's just so beautiful. It's just the only word I can think of. So congratulations.
Thank you, Stacey.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Brian and Raphael for joining me today. For more information on Secrets of the Whales, please visit natgeotv.com/FYC. I'm Stacey Wilson-Hunt, and this has been the making of a Nat Geo podcast. Thank you so much for listening. The Making of a Nat Geo Podcast is a National Geographic production. Executive producers, Stephanie Montgomery and Chris Alpert. Host, Stacey Wilson-Hunt. Writers and producers, Dave Biesing, Thomas Green, Jason Jackson, Kevin Horton, and Stacey Wilson-Hunt. Associate producer, Shanna Blackman. And production coordinator, Juliana Parisi. In association with Benstown, McVeigh Media, and Sound That Brands.